Good evening, everybody.
There's one translation of one of the four Bodhisattva vows that we do at the end that starts out, all beings, one body. And I was feeling all beings as one body with a kind of itchy throat and a little extra saliva and kind of a little bit of cough going on, and sharing that throughout the Zendo. And there's a lovely way in which that's kind of literally and specifically what it means, that we were kind of all partaking of the same bodily experience right there. That's not the topic of my talk, though, tonight. Tonight I want to talk about gathas. We use this word a couple of times in the in our liturgy service. We start with the gatha of atonement, and then at the end we dedicate all our gathas and our sutras to the many beings of the world. A gatha is, so this word is spelled G-A-T-H-A, and this T-H sound that's transliterated from Sanskrit is actually a aspirated glottal stop. It's not actually a th sound, so it's just pronounced gatha. And gathas are short verses of reminder verses, or verses for remembrance. and they kind of focus the mind on the karma of aspiration. Karma is all of what we do with our intentions and how our intentions become manifest in thought, become manifest in words, and become manifest in deeds. All of that is our karma. And karma is the kind of the way that we use our mind. And we start with the gatha of atonement. And so what these gathas of aspiration do is remind us how we're hoping to use our mind. What reminding us how we're hoping to act in the relative world of phenomena, in the world where there is good and bad and harming and non-harming. Which is one side of the picture, the relative world of what Zen deals with. Zen also deals with the absolute world, the realm in which good and bad fall away, in which all of those dualistic things are seen to be just thoughts, just judgments, mental dharmas arising and passing away. And part of what we do in Zazen is intimately encounter the space that is beyond all that thing. But then in our life, we also have a variety of challenging circumstances, and these are part of the things that the precepts point to. And we have in so much of our life the opportunity to be the person we mean to be the person that we aspire to be. This aspiration, there's a Sanskrit word called bodhicitta, which is the awakened heart. And the Mahayana view of bodhicitta, which is the larger school of Buddhism of which Zen is a part, that aspiration is to not only become free amid our own suffering, but to save and to serve and to liberate amid their suffering all other beings as well. That's the highest aspiration of a bodhisattva. That's the bodhisattva's intention, to serve and to save all beings, and not just all the beings that we see, but all beings throughout space and time. There's a few gathas that we use in Zen. There's more that you hear if you ever come on any of our meditation retreats. So In addition to the Gatha of Atonement, which I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about shortly, there's the evening Gatha, which is the last thing that we're all reminded of before we retire for the evening. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by, and opportunity is lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Awaken. Take heed. Do not squander your life. I want to take a moment to talk a little bit about the content of the Gatha of Atonement. So in this we say, all evil karma ever committed by me. So right here we're confronted with the word evil. And this is an advised choice on our part. There's other translations, and this could be also translated as harming karma or unwholesome karma. But it also is legitimately translated as evil. And so this is not evil in the sense of sin. This is evil in the sense of the stuff that we've done with our mind, body, and thought from beginningless time, from before our parents were born, all the way back, since of old. Evil, good and evil in this sense have to do with causing harm or not causing harm. And one of the values I feel in using this word evil right here is to remind us that the evil that we see out there, because you know it's easy to point at people and be sure that they're really manifesting the evil, but that comes from the same place, the same greed, anger, and ignorance that we see our own unskillful harming actions coming from. So another traditional gatha we do on retreat is the gatha on opening the sutra, which is a kind of which is what precedes the teacher's dharma talk, and it was historically what was done as the monks were taking down the sutras and opening them, and the sutras are the recorded sayings of the Buddha. And this is, I feel especially in the Gatha on opening the sutra, the kind of reminder quality, the kind of show up and be here now kind of quality to it. The Dharma, incomparably profound and infinitely subtle. And I also love that. Infinitely subtle. There's always more and more layers. You've never actually reached the bottom of it. And anytime you believe you've become certain about it, you're mistaken. There's more and more of it. So the Dharma, incomparably profound and infinitely subtle. John Tarrant, my teacher, James's teacher, said, you know, it's good as far as it goes, but we also could say the Dharma manifestly obvious and really straightforward. Is rarely encountered even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning. And so this is also not just the Dharma, which is the words of the Buddha. It's the Dharma, which is the teachings of the universe that we're continually receiving. Or that is continually available to us. And this is an expression of our aspiration to receive it, to notice it, to show up for it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning. And Tathagata is a name for a Buddha. It means the one of thusness, the one who is thus. We also do a gatha before the meals on retreat that remind us that eating and sustaining our life is killing. And there's the gatha, the verse of the Kesa which is that when we put on our raksus, these things that we get when we formally take the precepts, which are a miniaturized version of the Buddha's robe, the verse that we recite in one translation is, "Vast is the robe of liberation." So on one hand, this is the robe of liberation, the Buddha's robe, the aspiration to, with the heart of the Bodhisattva, follow and maintain the precepts for the benefit of all. This is the Buddha's robe, but also the Buddha's robe is far vaster than that. This is the Buddha's robe. This is the robe of liberation. This that we clothe ourselves in every moment is the robe of liberation. And also when we put on our t-shirt in the morning, that's the robe of liberation. A formless field of benefaction. I wear the Tathagata's teaching, saving all sentient beings. In monastic life in China and Japan, there were gathas for kind of like every piece of the day. And in Dogen, so there were gathas for waking up and for washing the face and for shaving the head. Here's one in the writings of Dogen. Dogen is the 13th century monk who brought who founded the Soto School of Zen, of which we're a part in Japan. And this is the gatha on brushing the teeth. "When I brush my teeth, I vow with all beings to have the eye teeth to conquer demons and bite through all afflictions." The pointy teeth or the eye teeth is, of course, your mouth. These practices are an interesting way to kind of make your entire life itself liturgy, and to remind yourself that every piece of it is practice and is the whole thing in itself. This little four-line form that Dogen uses is actually elaborated upon. This is a really, really lovely book. This is called The Dragon That Never Sleeps by Robert Aitken. And it's just a book, it's a collection of gathas, which are of Aitken's gathas that he's made up for his practice. And I have a sheet here that I'm going to give you shortly that has from a few different sources, which we're then going to talk about. But Aitken's this kind of four-line formula. One, the first line sets the occasion, such as when I brush my teeth, or when my efforts are clearly outclassed, or sounding the bell at the temple, or beginning our sutra service. And the second line is, I vow with all beings. And so this is part of that all beings, one body thing, that the practice, the path, is not just about you. Your practice isn't just yours. In fact, it isn't really yours at all. But even to the extent that it is, it's also, if you're really practicing the Zen way, in the service of all beings. I'm going to read you a little bit from Aitken's introduction to this book. "Making the vows my own is in keeping with the inner purpose of Mahayana practice, especially Zen practice. I make the reality of the Buddha's teaching my own. We are here only briefly, and we depend on each other. This reality is my own. Even more personally, this very body is the Buddha, which is, as Hakuin Zenji declared, which is what we recited today, this very body is the body of Buddha. This is my truth, told of my own body, spoken for me. Everything is affected each time I make a move." One of the teachings of interdependence in Buddhism is that acting anywhere is acting everywhere. And Dogen says that when one person sits zazen, the whole world sits zazen.
Everything is affected each time I make a move here in the grand net of the universe, and I rediscover my own Buddha nature. My vows, as I rediscover my own Buddha nature, my vows are naturally the vows of the Buddha that all beings be freed from their anguish. I vow with all beings is my compassionate vow. I vow and I yearn that all beings might vow with me. It is my invitation that we enter the noble way together. It is also my affirmation of the Buddha's wise teaching of harmony. I vow, and with universal affinities uniting everyone and everything, all beings are joining as I vow. Compassion and wisdom thus blend and are one as I repeat. I vow with all beings.
So the first line sets the occasion. The second line is the act of vowing with all beings. And it's this act of doing which is also related to the act of atoning that we do in the Gatha of Atonement. It is a action in itself. It is karma right now. The karma of doing it has effects. It doesn't matter actually how it unfolds. The act of using your mind in this way to make this vow has an effect that will kind of ripple out in mysterious ways that you don't stand a chance of being able to put your finger on and knowing for sure. And then the second and third lines are the specifics of the conduct that one intends to do. So here are a couple of agents. Preparing to enter the shower, I vow with all beings to wash off the last residue of thoughts about being pure. When I turn into somebody nasty, I vow with all beings to reflect on how it all happened and uncover my long hidden tail. This is the tail that gets stuck after the entire giant body of the ox passes through magically through the window, and yet the tail gets stuck. Or this is the tail that's the snake's tail. That's the opposite of the dragon's tail. Dragons are great enlightened beings, and snakes are kind of just snakes. Buddhist lore. When a demon disrupts my zazen, I vow with all beings to remember who generates demons and return with a smile to my breath. When I was transcribing this one onto this little sheet, I transcribed it as, when I, demon, disrupts my zazen, I vow with all beings to remember who generates demons. Aitken also has one here about that to me is about working on koans with the teacher. When I enter the interview room, I vow with all beings to trust my innate gumption and simply say it or do it. And then I have a number of more epic ones here. Facing my imminent death, I vow with all beings to go with the natural process, at peace with whatever comes. So I'm going to give you this sheet, and we're going to talk about them a little more. Or actually, hopefully, we're going to break up and talk about them. But there's also one more here that I wanted to read that I didn't put in that list. And this is an indication of how this is a really great example of Robert Aitken taking this up as a practice in his area of difficulty. And I think it's very generous of him to be sharing this with us. He says, when women say I am sexist, I vow with all beings to ask for specific examples and give them a chance to sink in. And so this practice of taking up gathas, of vowing, of practicing bodhicitta, of practicing the karma of the aspiration of the bodhisattva, which I sometimes also shorthand as being the person you mean to be, isn't just huge and like you know, nebulous and lofty. It's specific, you know. It has to do with your specific issues. I want to read you a couple of other. So there's a practice to be had here of either of finding gathas that you relate to and using them, or of writing your own, and finding the things that are useful to you to reflect on, to focus your aspiration. For me, there was for a long time, the biblical saying, "And this too shall pass," was actually one that I used as a kind of gatha when I was at the mountain monastery, each time I put on my robe, I reflected on "This too shall pass." Whatever I was feeling, wherever I was, however great I was feeling, however, you know, enlightened or just miserable, or full or whatever. So a completely another approach, of which I also have some excerpts here, is one that Gene Smith, who's a meditation teacher in the insight meditation tradition. These are from a book called Now, The Art of Being Truly Present. These all use the word mindful, and the aspiration is in the form of "May I." May I be willing to mindfully cultivate the effort I need to pursue spiritual growth on the middle path, acknowledging that I and everyone I love will die. May I cherish the blessings that appear in my life and those with whom I share them. And so this is also a kind of more positively framed other side of what is really implicit in our five remembrances. I am of the nature to grow old. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change. There's no way to be separated from them. And so that this gives voice to the unvoiced other side of them. May I clearly see my daily undertakings and long-range goals and mindfully pursue them without making my happiness dependent upon my expectations. May I cultivate in myself the stability of mountains, strengthened by the insight their perspective brings. Mindfully letting go of guilt and remorse, may I draw on experiences of the past to shape a present that will cause neither guilt nor remorse in the future. And this is also kind of another frame of the gatha of atoning. That's what we're doing when we're atoning, is we're mindfully letting go of the harm and karma we've caused, the evil karma we've created, and that is created but is not ours. And with our aspiration and our attention, we're trying to create the present that will serve beings, save beings, create neither guilt nor remorse in the future. At the bottom of the sheet, on the back, I have a couple of other quotes which are kind of gatha-esque that I wanted to include. One is actually from Waldo Emerson. Finish each day and have done with it. You have done what you could. Some blunders have crept in. Forget them as soon as you can. Tomorrow is a new day. You shall begin it serenely and with too high a spirit to be encumbered with your old nonsense. Which is also a kind of gatha of atonement, I think. The other kind of oddball one that's here is one that I actually was considering getting tattooed on my very person, except for the fact that various tattooed people tell me that English tattoos of words is a very bad idea because they believe in faith. So I didn't actually do it, but I really wish I could. And I might anyhow, despite people's sound advice.
This is from a woman named Kathleen Lewis Martin. Let compassion guide me, humility hold me, and courage temper my wild mind. Rare are the situations in my life where there's not a piece of that that's helpful to me in any struggle that I'm having. So what I want to do now is pass out these to y'all, and then as you read them over, I'd like you to pair up, as we do when we're doing our precepts discussions, just with the person next to you. Introduce yourself, and just take a few moments to share anything that you're. Any ones that catch you or that appeal to you or that you struggle against, or any reactions that you're having, and then we will come back together and see if anybody wants to talk about any of what that comes up. And if there's a person left over, then just form a group of three. Maybe just to start out, read them aloud to each other when you're looking at one, and then share a reaction with your partner. A couple about sex and the ache and the...
Thank you.
Even just sharing a reaction with your partner of, I like this one makes sense, I don't know what's going on here, is a place to start. So starting to wrap up wherever you are.
So that's the depth.
Right, why don't we come back together? Does anyone want to share some of their reactions or questions or discussion or thoughts or anything? Anyone want to dive courageously in? Sorry.
We had a lot to talk about, so we didn't get to all of them, but the one that kind of struck me was in thoughts on an endless procession.
The one in Aitken on the second column.
The one that struck me is on this one right about here in the middle page. It says, when thoughts form an endless procession. And as soon as I read that, I went, my mind just goes like, you know, one thing after the other. First it's this, and then it's this, and you just like, I vow with all beings to notice the spaces between them. And when my mind's going so fast, you know, I don't even know there are any spaces between them. And give the thrushes a chance. I love that. I'm a birder. So the idea of as my mind is racing along to try with all, what did you say, with all beings, to bow with all beings, to notice the spaces. But see, as soon as the word thrush was in there, it wasn't just a space. I'm also a hiker. So the next thing that came into my mind was the space. I saw these beautiful green trees and the woodlands, you know, and there was the thrush. So that's what my spaces between my thoughts are going to look like now after reading this. Thank you.
I always like the second one on the other side. respect and remind you, I have a supreme importance. Time quickly passes by and opportunities lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Awaken, take heed, do not squander your life. The voice felt that the worst effects of a tradition are worthless. Where if you can see something coming, maybe you can make a choice instead of just saying, doing the default, whatever, that maybe isn't what you really want. But I just, and I think that this is one of the things I think should be really helpful.
And in monastic Zen, that's how it's done. Every night ends with this. Yeah. So, you know, these are the kind of things that you know, if they speak to you, you know, copy them down and put them on your fridge or put them on a little sticky on your monitor at work, you know.
Can I just say something about that one? What, that one took a new meaning for me, too, when I found out that in the form of at our sashimis, it's being said by a ghost. And when I understood that, that it was someone's, you know, reminding us, someone who'd already passed on and saying, I know what it's like, pay attention, you know, kind of thing. Mm. And that was, it just kind of took on a whole different, in a good way.
So, in our tradition on retreat, the person who says this gatha at the end is pretending to be giving voice to a ghost of a departed ancestor. But you don't actually need any focus. But, yeah.
As you were talking about the first one, and you touched on it too about evil karma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were talking about, you know, what is the objective measure of something, of what is harmful or not harmful, or good or bad, or
And from the perspective of Buddhism, on the one hand, part of the answer is there isn't an objective an objective measure, and you can't ever know. And in fact, being certain that you know is a manifestation of ignorance. And people who are certain that they know what's good or bad can cause a great deal of harm. And so part of what we practice is looking carefully at our own certainty. But what's important is, so this is again where it comes to aspiration. It's your intention that is kind of all you have control over. And so to be really choicefully, mindfully present to the decisions that you're making, that's the best you can do. And then, you know, it could unfold good, it could unfold bad. And even if it seems to unfold bad, then, you know, later in another iteration, it could end up being good. You know, and so there isn't like, and we talk about beginningless karma. So there isn't a beginning point, but there also isn't an end point. There isn't a point where the karma is exhausted and now you can decisively know for sure how things have turned out. And so this the practice from a Buddhist perspective is to connect with your aspiration to be the person you mean to be. And from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, it also adds on in the service of others. Excellent question. You guys were chatting.
I also really like
The karma of vowing is vowing, you know, so it's the doing, you're doing it by vowing, and it isn't about, there's one here that's about expectations, you know, which there's a may I one about expectations, let your goals mindfully without making your happiness dependent on my expectations, or the outcome. And so this is again that the aspiration, the intention that you bring to it, in this moment is the transformative power thing of it. It isn't about how it turns out later. And this is a lovely example of why it's so wonderful that there's different teachers expressing themselves in different ways. There's also a way in which may I, it isn't a permission asking may I, but it can be a kind of letting go, there's a creating the thing and then letting go of all doing around it, which may I captures and vow kind of keeps as ours and our action, and so there's really rich positive sides to both of them. So I encourage you, as with all things like this, you know, to practice the ones that call to you, but also especially explore the ones that you react to. And with like all of our sutra service too, you know, there's like lots of stuff in there. Like whenever you find yourself going, "Oh, I hate that part," you know, I invite you to look at that, and I really invite you to at some point bring that up in a discussion, because I'm sure you're not the only one thinking of it. And there's something really interesting there, I'm sure.
Where is that?
Top of the Gene Smith second column, right across from traditional Zen, all evil karma. May I face the painful experiences that are inevitably part of life with mindfulness instead of embellishing stories that increase my suffering. And I really like what you said about at least knowing you have that option. So there's part of what I find so comforting about Dharma practice is that independent of whether in any given instance I successfully do what I mean to be doing, you know, like to know that I always in principle can, you know, there's a lot of comfort to be had there, you know, and there's a way in which being able to recognize that, being able to even just say that to yourself, is starting to stop identifying with the story that you're telling and embellishing, you know. Embellishing stories that increase my own suffering. And this is our specialty, of course, is amplifying our suffering. And there's a quote which has been attributed, I've seen everywhere from the Buddha to Oscar Wilde, that says, pain is inevitable, suffering is not. And it's this embellishment that adds that suffering quality to the inevitabilities of pain and to the inevitabilities of sickness, old age, death, loss, change.
And I also thought in terms of myself, that may I mindfully speak words that are
That's a really great point. And so there's karma of words and actions, but there's also karmas of thought. And the way we talk to ourselves, you know, the way we talk to ourselves is so obnoxious so much of the time. And to be mindfully, vigilantly aware of our inner dialogue with ourselves, you know, like I mean, how do you address yourself? I often notice that I address myself as, "Hey, asshole," you know, or something like that. That's my inner dialogue, and that's not right speech. It doesn't have to be directed at anyone else. It's just talking to yourself like that. And so what this one that Lisa has called to our attention, this is Jean Smith's presentation of right speech. So the Buddha's description of right speech includes useful, timely, and wise. And if you look at the 10 great precepts, three of them are concerned with how you talk. And you can do a lot of, you can create a lot of harm by talking to yourself uncompassionately. And to notice that is, and what you're doing also is you're reinforcing the karma of aversion. You're reinforcing the mind of anger and the mind of separateness and the mind of things as they are not okay. And attention to that is crucial. Thank you for making us. So let's conclude with the four Bodhisattva vows. Yeah. And take these home, please, if you think you might be at all interested in them.